think that it sounds like we're picking it up all right. That's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do is just sort of prompt you with some questions, and
I hope I can answer them.
Oh, I'm sure. To begin with, let me indicate for the record that today is November 14th.
November the 14th.
And this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. Thomas Mastin at his home in Waite Hill, Ohio. Dr. Mastin, I know you were born in Newcastle, Indiana.
That's right.
Was it 1913? I'm not sure of the year and the date.
December 19th, 1913.
Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Well, my father worked in a steel mill, and he died when I was 11 years old. And my mother was sort of destitute after that because the family had very little money, but she had to take in washings and the neighbors, and we even had a boarder come in a small house and stay there and make enough money to buy food for the kids. That was a pretty bad situation there for quite a while. She finally got married again and a number of years later, and that helped the situation quite a bit. There were six of us children in the family. The oldest daughter of our parents died when I was young. She was 12 years older than I was, and she died of pneumonia when she'd been married when she died. That's about it, I guess.
You received all of your early education in Newcastle?
Right.
You listed on your form that you filled out that there was a Mr. Bronson in high school who had an influence on your life.
That's true. He was a chemistry teacher there in Newcastle High School. And I'm not quite sure how I decided to take a course in chemistry, but I did. And he seemed to take a liking to me, and he'd even take me out to his home in the evenings and teach me more than I learned in the class, gave me some books to read, and I really became fascinated with the subject of chemistry, primarily because of his attention to me. And he was a great teacher. I don't know if he did that with other students, but he probably did, and inspired most of them very well.
I understand that you were contemplating leaving school at 16 because you didn't find it very interesting until this particular course.
That's true. I told my mother that I was going to quit school at the age of 16. I had to go that far according to the law of Ohio, or Indiana, I guess. And but I started taking chemistry and decided I'm not going to quit.
You then went on to Wabash College, but I'm not sure when you started at Wabash and why did you go there?
Because Mr. Bronson graduated from there and he recommended Wabash to me. And I started in Wabash, let's see, I got out of high school about 32. I don't know if it was 32 or 33, something like that.
Well, this was the depths of the Depression.
Yeah.
How did you finance your college education?
Well, I had to come home every summer and worked in a steel mill. That's the same one that my father worked in. And I earned enough money to go back and pay the tuition for the next year or whatever. When I graduated from Wabash, I owed them $1,200 because they helped me out in a few cases there. I paid it off after I made enough money.
What was the chemistry department like at Wabash?
Well, Dr. L.V. Howell was the head of the chemistry department, and that's who all the courses I took was under him. And he had the reputation of being the toughest teacher in the whole college, and he was. The first course I took, he had the first exam I took in the class. He came in on the blackboard and he had all the grades on a line on the blackboard from the highest down to the lowest. And he said that the ones that are at the lowest here are going to get kicked out of this class. And he kicked them out, including his own son. But he taught chemistry in a very effective way. And I did research for him for 1 year after I graduated, actually, because Wabash wouldn't let me take chemistry in the first year because it's a liberal arts school. They wanted you to concentrate on that liberal arts. So I didn't take chemistry the first year. So when I graduated, I wanted to go to the University of Illinois because Dr. Howell recommended that to me. I had one course that they were required to get into Illinois, and I hadn't taken it because I missed that first year. So I stayed another year and took a course and also did some research under Dr. Howell's direction. And he gave me a project that was to make a metal acetylide, and none had ever been made before, ever been reported in the literature. I can't remember if it was sodium acetylide or something like that. Well, I finally got it made, and I was weighing out the dried sample in a very expensive balance in the laboratory. And while it was drying, I was turned the other way, fortunately. The darn thing blew up and wrecked the balance and everything. Well, we wrote a paper saying, don't ever make this thing. That's the first time it was ever made and didn't know it was going to blow up. Of course, the satellites are very important, are very explosive anyway. Now, that's about my education at Wabash, I guess.
Were there many other chemistry majors?
About four. It was a small school, about 400 students. And I think, while I was in the lab anyway, there was about three others, or maybe three or four others with me, doing research in the labs.
Was Howell an organic chemist?
Yeah.
And you went to Illinois then on his recommendation?
All right.
What was it like at Illinois when you got there?
Well, it was kind of interesting because the first day all the new freshmen in chemistry were called together, and the dean got up and said, we've got enough space here to take all you people this year, but 30% of you are not going to be back next year because we'll be out of space, out of room. So here I was going through the first year saying, am I going to pass this thing or not? That was just as tough as a Wabash. In many ways, more difficult. And I passed it well enough to continue on there. And I did okay on my grades. There's one experience I'll never forget. If you want me to continue talking
please,
these things.
Please.
I was taking thermodynamics. And the professor in that course was known as very difficult, and he gave one exam in the middle of the semester, or maybe near the end, I don't know, and that was that exam counts for half of your credits, and your papers you put in the meantime for half of them. Well, the three blackboards in that room were covered with questions, and I got through them all. I knew the questions. I knew the answers. But unfortunately, and I can't understand this, I didn't see the last question on the board. I thought I was through. And everybody was still sitting there working. And I checked everything out, and I said, well, I might as well get up and leave. Well, I got a C on that. And you get a C in graduate school, that's bad. So I go back in and see this professor. How's come I got a C? He says, you didn't answer the last question. And I said, well, son of a gun, I didn't even see that on the board. And I said, I'll take the whole exam over. Give me more different questions. And no way. I could not talk him into doing anything to prove that I knew this course. So I was worried about being kicked out because they were tough over there. A C is no good in graduate school. But I hung in and stayed until I graduated. I'll never forget that old guy. He was, I can't imagine anybody by that mean.
How did you begin your association with Carl Marvel?
He's the one I did my doctor's degree under. He was my whatever they call it. I worked for him and did the research under him. And I took some courses that he wasn't involved in, like this thermodynamics and that sort of thing, inorganic chemistry, all these things. But I did my thesis in organic chemistry working on vinyl polymers. Those were new in those days. And, well, we wrote two or three papers, and or he did. You probably got them in your collection.
Did you select Marvel, and why did you select him to work for?
I don't know. I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think he was, I'd heard from others that he was probably the best teacher there, and in organic. So I'm not sure how I got to work for him in my thesis, but I knew he was a good man there, and I probably went to talk with him. I can't remember the details of it.
And it was he who introduced you to birds, or had you had an interest in birds before that?
He introduced me. I went out with him a number of weekends looking at birds, and, you know, he told me one time if he had it all a do-over, he would be an ornithologist and not a chemist, because he loved birds so much. And he inspired a lot of students. So I remember going out with a whole gang of, well, maybe 10, 15 people from a school along the lake somewhere over there in Champaign, Urbana, with Marvel and looking at birds and so forth. That's how I got interested in birds, at least in part.
And you've pursued that all your life, haven't you?
Yes. I'm not an expert at it, but I've done a lot of photographing. That's my hobby, and of birds, and I've been out with a number of different people on bird watches, so-called. But I'm not like some of them that know every bird in the country.
Well, you have a marvelous location here, too, for yeah. I'm sure there are lots of birds here.
Yeah. I feed them all year long, and I know all of them around here anyway. I think I do.
I noticed a number of snow geese coming out. Do they winter here now? Are they wintering here?
They do come through here migrating. I don't believe they stay over winter.
Okay. Because where I'm living outside of Philadelphia, there are a number of them that stay there all winter long.
Uh-huh. There may be some of them do that. Well, that, matter of fact, I know I saw one in the late fall, at least, down on the pond. There's a pond down below here. So they may stay all winter.
When you were in Illinois, of course, Illinois had the reputation, probably one of the finest chemistry departments in the country. Still does, but at that time it was certainly a powerhouse.
Yeah.
What had you thought about doing when you were, well, the war had started. You got your PhD in 42, so the war had already started.
Yeah.
But had you, what thoughts were you giving to your career as you were working through your graduate program?
Well, I graduated in 42, and you know the American Chemical Society has two meetings a year. I was a member, a student member of that, and I know they had a clearinghouse for graduates looking for jobs. So in the fall of 42, I went to the meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. They have them all over the country, various places. I put my resume in this clearinghouse file, and I was interviewed by three or four different chemical companies, but I made up my mind, probably even before I went down there, that I was not going to take a job with a big company, big chemical company, like DuPont, Celanese, or I didn't want to go with one of those companies.
Why didn't you want a big company?
Well, I know what I said to myself. I said, a big company, I would just be a spoke in another big wheel. And I don't want to be that way. And that was all my thinking that I put on it. And so there was a fellow came to interview me by the name of Carl Prutton. You may know him.
Studied his physical chemistry text.
Yeah. He was a case tech at the time, head of the department. And he was a consultant for Cleveland Industrial Research, which I didn't never heard of. But he interviewed me and told me that he was looking for somebody for Cleveland Industrial Research. I said, well, how many research people do they have? He said, seven. Well, that's all. And that company was operating and doing research in the laboratories, the basement laboratories of Case Tech at that time. One of the founders of Lubrizol had set up that as an arm of the research department of Lubrizol. That's the only place they had to go. They were building a new lab out in Wickliffe here. Excuse me. So I worked in that basement laboratory at Case Tech for a few months with these other six chemists, and then we moved out to the new research building in Wickliffe. And they didn't have anyone in that group that had a PhD degree. But there was a head of the laboratory by the name of Del Fry. So he was my boss. And he hated my guts. I couldn't do anything right for him. You want the rest of this story?
Sure, sure.
So I just couldn't please him no matter what I did. I even made a compound there in the lab that was patented, but God didn't make any difference. So I decided, if I can last for a year, I'm going to get out of this place. Because I didn't want to get fired before a year, and then I'd have a hard time getting another job, I figured. So I went through this mess for 9 months. And then Calvin Smith, one of the founders of the company, is who I interviewed me when I was hired, asked me to come in his office, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get fired. I was sure that he's the one that would do it. Well, I sat down in front of his desk, and he chatted with me a little while, and then he said, I understand you and Del Frey are making out. I said, that's right. I can't do anything right. I can't do anything that he approves. And then he says, well, you think you know how to run a laboratory? I said, no, I don't know how to run a laboratory. I've never had any experience like that. I just wanted to be a chemist at the bench and hopefully make some products that are worthwhile. And then he said, well, would you like to try running a laboratory? And I was still sort of upset, and I said, I'll try anything once. That was not a good answer. But then he said, okay, you've got the job. They've never told me, but I'm sure that Prutton went down to Tennessee to find someone to head up that new lab. I was never told that, though, anytime, afterwards or before. So I got to head up the research lab 9 months after all this hard luck I was having with Fry.
What kind of things did he have you doing?
Del Frey? Well, making, synthesizing different products that might be useful in lubricants. And I was working on sulfur compounds, phosphor compounds, things like that. I made a product at one time that didn't work in the lubricants, but it since then, it was turned out to be one of the best insecticides I ever made. And I had it there in my lab and didn't do anything with it. Like Darvon or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Phosphorus sulfur. Should have patented that.
But you weren't thinking about those uses for those materials at that time. Did Fry leave then when you took over?
Calvin Smith sent him back to Case to get some higher education, and he did, and the company paid for it, but he never came back to work for us. I think I know one reason.
Do you suspect that the difficulty he had was because you had a PhD and he didn't?
It's the only thing I can think of. He didn't have problems with anybody else.
Well, that was quite a responsibility to take on then, in a very short time. You were given a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
What did you do first?
Well, I'd been working there in the bench myself, and I knew all the other chemists, and I knew what they were doing, and we cooperated back and forth, you know, talked to each other. And it was a very friendly group, and all I did after that was sit down occasionally with them and say, what do we do now, and what kind of compounds do we think we ought to make? And, you know, we worked jointly and figured out some new products, and we got some pretty good ones. And the company was so successful that, unbelievably, They're written up in the Plain Dealer as one of the fastest growing companies in the country in the chemical industry. In the days I was there, 40 years. And I can tell you that the growth there was in excess of 10% compounded, both in revenues and earnings, for all those 40 years. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even more, 15 or so percent. So that company really grew rapidly and very successful. They were the first company that went into this business and that they're trying to improve lubricants by additives to the lubricants. And the war came along at that time, and the military started using them, and that really boosted the company's revenues a great deal during that First World War, or second. They bought a lot of it, and then that got the automotive industry into it and so forth.
Well, when you joined, the war was already on, so that must have been a very busy and active time.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you say, you commented that you really just sort of let people have freedom in exploring different kinds of things. Were there any restrictions you placed on them? I'm talking about doing basic research as opposed to applied research.
No, I don't think I put any restrictions on them. If we discussed things, I mean, I knew every product everybody was trying to make. And I'm sure that at times somebody would say, why don't we try this? And maybe I'd say, no, that's too difficult or something like that. I was the only PhD in the group for a while there, see. And I knew my organic chemistry better than any rest of them, presumably at least. And so we'd pick out things that I had to prove. Anything that they try to manufacture, you know, to synthesize in the laboratories. And I knew what had already been made and what some of them were beginning to look promising and interesting. So we continued in that area somewhat. One of the most creative chemists that I hired later on is still one of my best friends. It was Bill LeSueur. And that fellow had more brilliant ideas than any of us in the lab. Mm. And he came back over the years. He was working there almost as long as I did. He had about 50 patents of products that he thought were worth making. And most of them were useful, and he was one of the very brilliant fellows.
Did you continue to do any lab work yourself, or did you stop working at the bench?
I stopped working at the bench not right away. I did some work at the lab and the bench at the bench for a while there. I don't know how long, because it wasn't far beyond that I was given the job of directing research and development, which was a pilot plant, and I was pretty busy. I didn't, after I got that part, I don't think I did any more work on that.
One of the things...